As you know, we are recording the oral arguments here today. So for purposes of the recording, I'll just note that today is January 29th, 2025. I'm Judge Cochran, joined today by Judge Sleater and Judge Larson. The first case on our calendar is A24-0739, Frank E. Carpenter III et al. Respondents versus Michael Carpenter et al. Appellants. Counsel will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellants will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. You can proceed when you're ready. We just ask that you introduce yourself and the party you or parties you represent at the beginning of your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Robert Kuba, KOUB as in boy A, and I represent appellants Michael Carpenter, Castle Highlands Golf Course, LLC, and Carpenter Enterprises, LLC. Before we begin, I just want to make a note that I'll be referencing the parties by their first name just to avoid confusion, as the parties share a common last name in this case. The only purpose of that is to avoid any confusion. The crux of this appeal and the crux of this case boils down to one main idea. Respondents either can't or won't perform their obligations that they agreed to when they settled the underlying case. This morning, I want to draw the court's attention to three main points. First, the district court erred when it held that the settlement agreement did not fully and finally resolve all issues between the parties, including the golf course property, and when it held that the settlement agreement did not create any obligations for respondents to produce a clean title. Two, to the extent that this court does believe that the language in the settlement agreement is ambiguous, the extrinsic evidence supports the determination that the intent of the parties was to fully and finally resolve all issues, including issues of real estate. Finally, the court erred in not awarding appellants their attorney's fees pursuant to the settlement agreement.
Mr. Kubik, on your first point, can I just clarify? I didn't read the district court's order to say it wasn't a full and final resolution as between the parties, but the judge simply made the point that a spouse was not a party. So am I misinterpreting what the judge said? In other words, it really wasn't the question before the district court whether there was a full and final settlement between the parties, but just whether a spouse or maybe a party is obligated to insist a spouse do something is a little different.
Your Honor, I believe both of those points are intertwined in this case. This case comes down to one thing. There were the parties involved were Fonda, Frank III, and the estate. Fonda was named both individually and as the personal representative of Frank II's estate. In addition, the settlement agreement also contemplated resolution of a claim made by appellants in the probate case. The district court, in ordering its ruling, it erred when it found that respondents do not need to perform their obligations to provide clear title. The import of that is in order to provide clear title, respondents were required to either obtain their spouse's approval to transfer title or that they had their spouse's approval to transfer title. In fact, to the extent that respondents claim they didn't have their spouse's approval to transfer title, they couldn't have transferred title at all.
So are you claiming that a spouse is an agent under the settlement agreement? I guess I'm trying to understand how you're tying, how you are connecting the requirement for the spouse to do something in a contract that I think everyone admits the spouse didn't sign. What is the language in particular in the contract that you would point to say that there's an obligation of the spouse to do something?
Certainly, Your Honor. There are a couple places I would point to. First is in the authority section. I believe it's paragraph 14. Respondents in signing indicated that they had the authority of all owners. And if you read that in connection with the rest of the settlement agreement, the intent there is that respondents are indicating that they have the authority to transfer the real title to the golf course property entirely to appellants. Additionally, the settlement agreement obligation and requires that respondents are.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Sorry. I thought you were done. So go ahead. I'll ask my question when you're done.
Sorry, Your Honor. Again, if you read the settlement agreement, it's in its entirety, it creates an obligation whereby respondents are going to transfer the entirety of the title and real property to appellants. However,
I guess my question is, why isn't it also a reasonable reading of the settlement agreement to say that the parties agreed to transfer whatever interest that they had? Do you know what I'm saying? I'm asking something specific, which is, where would we look in the language of the settlement agreement to see that this is not about the property held by the individuals slash corporations in this company, but that this also went to spouses, other family members, all other interests that might have been part of the probate portion of this disagreement?
Certainly are. And I think the fact that the estate was a party to this settlement agreement requires the estate to transfer any title interests the estate might have. In Minnesota law, when someone dies, the beneficiaries receive a interest in whatever residual assets of the estate, but that interest is subject to any debts or liabilities of the estate. Here, this litigation, as well as the probate claim, was a debt or liability of the estate. And the estate, in resolving this matter, indicated or averred, and again, respondents joined them in stating that we will give you title to the real property of the golf course, and we will give you all interests in the LLC, and we will fully, forever, and finally be done. And that language is strewn throughout the agreement. In paragraph one, in the initial opening, it indicates that the intent of the parties is to be fully and finally done with one another. Paragraph three is a very broad release paragraph that indicates that we are releasing all claims, whether to the business, real estate, or otherwise. Paragraph four indicates that respondents will do whatever is necessary to effect what is required of them in this obligation. And again, paragraph 14 indicates that to the extent that they are required to obtain the authority from other third-party individuals, they have done so.
So I want to circle back to paragraph 14. I think you said that paragraph 14, through that, they represented that they had the agreement of all owners. But I don't think that's exactly what paragraph 14 says. It says each of the signatories represent that they have secured necessary authorizations of approvals of their respective owners, boards of directors, or agents to execute this agreement on their behalf and to bind themselves, their company, and their clients. So there, it's talking about owners of a company, not a spouse, in my reading of it. How do you get that spouses are included within this, that they have the agreement of spouses with, as read into paragraph 14?
Your Honor, when you read the entirety of the agreement and you look at what is in the four corners of the agreement as to what the intent of the parties are, it's clear that that language of respective owners indicates that respondents either have or will obtain the necessary authority of any potential owner of any interest in the property. For example, to the extent the parties wanted to limit that language to be only applying to businesses, there are no businesses that were plaintiffs or respondents in this case. The fact
but it
that
does say their company and their clients.
Yes, Your Honor, that we read that as an additional thing. So, for example, it requires the authority of any potential owners. It requires the authority of any directors or agents to the extent that they are there. And it requires the authority of any company and their clients.
Thank you.
Mr. Kuba, isn't the real issue that no one that led to this problem is apparently no one, or at least the attorney, was not aware that Frank too owned part of the real estate of which the golf course is on individually, and hence obviously there might have been some different language. But I just to follow up then on your point here today, what if Frank too had in his will, again, not no one knew it, transferred gave the property to a third non-related third party? Because obviously no one knew that, or at least that's what the record seems to indicate, that he had a personal interest in this land. By your reading of this language, that would obligate the respondents to either have to pay this third party the equivalent or somehow do something to require that person to transfer it to your client. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, but I think it's important here to understand, first off, who brought the initial lawsuit. Plaintiffs brought a lawsuit against defendants. Secondly,
What's the relevance of that to the settlement agreement?
Your Honor, I believe the relevance to that is it's clear that in the underlying case, what respondents were trying to do is they were suing for interest in all of that stuff, the business, the LLC, the real estate. Secondly, there's the record indicates that respondents were aware that the golf course property was titled individually in Frank II's name. That was never disclosed up until up until appellant discovered in May of 2023, after the settlement agreement had been signed, that there was other interests in the name solely of Frank II. And third, again, I go back to the idea that the estate was a part of not only this settlement, but of the litigation as a whole. And again, the estate is the estate of Frank II and would be entitled and have control over any potential interests that Frank II individually had. So by the fact that the estate was a party to this agreement, signed this agreement, averred that it would transfer all right and title in the business, in the LLC, and in the real property, respondents have not done that. And that is why we're here today. To the extent the court finds the language in the settlement agreement to be ambiguous, the extrinsic evidence further supports the idea that this was supposed to be a full and final resolution. And that gets to the Baker case, which we cited in our briefing. The Baker case stands for the premise that all settlement agreements are supposed to be final. The court generally does not want loose ends when you're settling a case unless something is specifically reserved. Again, here, respondents were aware that Frank II could have an individual interest in the real property. They had every opportunity to carve out an exception and to maintain potential interests that they thought they may have in the real property through that individual interest. They did not do so. There is no reservation of rights anywhere in the settlement agreement. And in fact, the very broad language of the release indicates that there was no intent to reserve any rights. Similarly, supporting that is 15 minutes after the mediator sent out the mediator's proposal, which ultimately was the basis for the settlement agreement, the mediator followed up and said, obviously, this would include the transfer of any right, title, or interest in the golf course property.
My question, though, is, I mean, if we take this and we look at this case from wife's perspective, I don't think that we have any evidence in the record to indicate that wife has been part of any of these conversations, that she necessarily understands what the implications of this agreement are. What do we have in the record to support that any indication that wife knew what was happening, such that looking at extrinsic evidence, we should bind her to a contract she didn't sign?
There is some evidence that indicates that the wife was aware of this litigation as well as aware of a potential interest. And I believe that comes from an affidavit submitted by Frank III, where he discussed the fact that he was in a divorce, that the divorce was contentious, and that he did not believe that he could obtain a signature from his wife without having to pay her in that divorce.
Is that post-settlement agreement? Wasn't that affidavit post execution of the settlement agreement? I guess my question is, what evidence do we have at the time the settlement agreement was signed that wife knew that this was happening and understood that she would be bound? I mean, at the point that we're looking at extrinsic evidence, it seems to me like you'd be pointing me to wife is on some emails or that there's some kind of indication that she knew that she was a party to this.
Your Honor, as far as I'm aware, there is no evidence in the record that she was directly involved with communications about the settlement agreement.
Okay.
And just briefly, finally, Your Honor, to touch on my last point, The court erred in not awarding appellant their attorney's fees pursuant to the settlement agreement. The court relied on a case. It's slipping my mind now. I believe it's Prairie something. I apologize, Your Honor. It's slipping my mind at the moment. But in that case, the main difference is there was no language that directed the court to award attorney's fees. Here, in the attorney fee provision of the settlement agreement, it allows the court to determine the prevailing party, and the court can direct that party to be awarded their attorney's fees. That is.
Do you agree that the way the provision is written is permissive? And if so, you know, regardless of whether we agree with the application of that case or not, did the district court have the authority to just say, we don't, even if you are the prevailing party, we don't think attorney's fees are warranted?
Your Honor, I believe that the way that that provision is written, I believe that to the extent that there is a prevailing party in a matter in litigation, that attorney's fees are to be awarded. I see my time's up. Do you want me to stop or can I finish my thought?
You may answer.
Thank you. Again, in this case, in the district court's order, there was no discussion about I'm not ordering these because I'm choosing not to. The determination was that it would require a jury. And in this case, the provision as written is a waiver of that, and it allows the court to direct those attorney's fees.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is John Nevy, N-E, V as in Victor, E. And I represent the respondents, Frank Carpenter III, Fonda Carpenter, and the estate of Frank Carpenter II. The scope of this appeal, the issue on appeal is very narrow. It's just whether was the district court correct when it found that the settlement agreement did not compel the procurement of spousal deeds. The judge was very thorough in reviewing the settlement agreement, did a detailed analysis and said, there is no requirement that a non-party, a spouse outside of this agreement was bound by it. And so the motion failed. And also the district court was correct. It did not abuse its discretion on its decision on attorney's fees. Would have liked it to grant it. It found that we were the prevailing party, but the court denied an application without prejudice, well within the court's discretion.
But I understand that in the order that the district court ultimately issued, that you prevailed on the issues that you disputed. But it does seem to me from reviewing the record that the main issue here was whether or not your clients needed to transfer title, and it wasn't until the hearing that your clients conceded that they did need to do that. And so what are we supposed to do with a case where sort of the main issue changed at the hearing? And obviously the appellants had incurred some attorney's fees up until the point of the hearing to contest the issue that you ultimately conceded.
So, Your Honor, I don't think that issue is actually before the court, because we provided the deeds. This is probably an issue for further proceedings after this appeal. We reached an agreement to resolve this matter. Mm-hmm. We said, we'll give you the deeds we can get, and we'll pay you $10,000, which we did. I sent the deeds over. My clients paid $10,000 to be done. And when they received those deeds, they said, well, where's Danielle Carpenter's signature? And I said, I can't get Danielle Carpenter's signature. We submitted an affidavit, said they're in a contentious divorce proceeding. We can't get it. And they said, well, we're going to bring this motion again. We argued in the second motion that, hey, we never resolved this. So we renew our arguments about the what is required by the settlement. So we did not concede that point. That, as I wrote in our brief, the judge found that we conceded that point. We disagree. I reviewed the transcript. I reviewed our proceedings. We never conceded that point.
So then weren't they prevailing on the main issue, even if it's on a what you would now say is an erroneous factual finding of the district court?
No, Your Honor, because you can't have it both ways. We either settled the case and gave them the deeds, or the court just assumed that the delete, she never really engaged the issue of the deeds from the parties.
Doesn't that require the idea, though, that litigation only means that you got an order from the court? I mean, it says the court in the matter of litigation. Doesn't litigation include motion practice that precedes the decision? And if that motion practice ultimately is what gives you to give them the deeds that they're asking for, that it required litigation for that action to happen, that litigation has in fact occurred and they've prevailed to the extent that it took litigation to persuade your clients to do something.
So, Your Honor,
and again, I'm asking from an interpretation of the settlement agreement perspective.
So our main contention from the very beginning, our main argument in the first motion is you're trying to impose the settlement agreement on non-parties. That was
I thought main argument was that they weren't entitled to the property under the language of the settlement.
Yes, we made that argument too, and we did. But
you weren't successful on that argument.
Correct. So that was the odd thing about the judge's order. She just basically assumed that the fact that we had delivered deeds, even though we contested in our motion papers the validity of transferring those deeds, she just assumed that fact that, hey, they did the deed. So they have, in my mind, complied with that. But she never really found that the settlement agreement required my clients to give those deeds. She just said, well, they did. And so the only issue I'm going to look at is spousal deeds. And that issue had been before the court from the very beginning, and we prevailed on that. And so, if we're going to get into the weeds on the attorney fee provision, you know, you're right. It was definitely it's a permissive attorney fee provision.
Well, this is my question because let's just hypothetically say that we agree with appellant that the district court's legal determination with regard to the, I think it's United Prairie case, that wasn't correct. Would we need to remand back to the district court, or are there other parts of the decision that we could look to say it otherwise wasn't an abuse of discretion because it was a permissive? Like, do you see the district court's decision wholly hinging on that legal determination, or do you think that they made findings outside of that?
And just for clarification purposes, you mean the legal conclusion that we were the prevailing party?
No, the legal conclusion that regarding the application of United Prairie and the need to have requested a jury determination.
So this is reviewed under an abuse of discretion. And
we look at legal errors de novo under abuse of discretion. Yeah.
Of course. But so she said, this judge is tired of this file. I will give you that. We've been in front of
her. She also thinks it should be in Beltrami County, but that's.
And so when she denied, she said, look, respondents, my clients, you're the prevailing party. You had no obligation to get Danielle Carpenter's. I find you the prevailing party because that was the main issue in this whole thing, according to the judge, probably, I would say, accurate. This is a closed file. I'm going to deny attorney's fees, which it says shall have authority, not shall. You shall have the authority. You can exercise that authority or not. That's a permissive attorney fee provision. And I'm going to have to go, I don't want a closed file turning into a jury trial on a case that I'm thought was resolved. Is that an abuse of discretion to say, hey, you've got provisions in the settlement agreement where you can go to arbitration, you can go to Tim Cook and get your attorney's fee issue, or I'm denying it without prejudice, go to Beltrami and figure it out there. I don't think that's an abuse of discretion, particularly in the context of a permissive attorney fee provision. So, Your Honor, I do think that the court was absolutely correct to find us the prevailing party and then also to reserve it, to kick the can down the road. That was entirely within her discretion under the settlement agreement language. And really, this case is about the settlement agreement language. And there's really four provisions that the appellants rely on, and none of them require spousal deeds. The first is the definition of parties. The parties are not Danielle Carpenter. It's not Fonda Carpenter's spouse. It's undisputed that the spouses are not parties. The complete relinquishment paragraph, which is paragraph 3, says Frank III, Fonda, and the estate fully relinquish their claims. It's very clear who it applies to. It names them by name. Paragraph 4, additional documents, again, that explicitly applies and names Frank III, Fonda, and the estate. It really is paragraph 14 that appellants really hang their hat on. And Your Honor, the Judge Janisch was very eloquent in debunking any idea that spouses are agents of their other spouse. Seems that they've pivoted somewhat in their reply brief, and now they're hanging their hats on their owners. But this reading of paragraph 14 makes no sense. It says, and Judge Cochran read it already, but each signator represents that they have secured necessary authorizations or approvals of Frank's, their respective owner. So Frank Carpenter III's owner, Frank Carpenter doesn't have an owner. Fonda Carpenter doesn't have an owner. The estate doesn't have an owner. Mr. Kuba misspoke when he said there's no company involved in this settlement. There were two LLCs. In fact, ownership in Castle Highlands LLC was the whole issue of the underlying litigation. There were two companies involved, the golf course, Carpenter Enterprises LLC. So that language is clearly for the corporate or company parties to this case. It says their board of directors. Frank III doesn't have a board of directors, neither do the other respondents. They're agents. Judge Janisch dealt with agents. And then it's to bind themselves, Frank, Fonda, the estate, their company, inapplicable to respondents, or their clients, inapplicable to the respondents.
So, Mr. Nivy, your point being, if they needed language that said, and their spouses.
Exactly.
And or maybe third party, I use the hypothetical, or any other part.
Exactly.
Your point being, if that would have been in there, even without them signing, the settlement agreement would have been, would obligated the party, at least, to do whatever the party would need to do, which I think is primarily the argument.
Yeah, Your Honor, that's a great hypothetical. Like if it said, I have the authorization of my spouse to enter this settlement agreement. If it was crystal clear on that, that'd be a different case, right? That's not here.
But your point is, Your Honor, the absence of that, and with this language, and the absence of that is why there just literally is no obligation.
Exactly.
So, following up on that, can we turn back to paragraph 1? Because I think appellants argue that apparent paragraph 1 evidences the party's intent to resolve all claims, and it references the golf course property, and they argue that this would necessarily include spousal interests in the real estate in order to resolve all claims. Can you address that argument?
Your Honor, yes, the intent of this agreement is to resolve all claims between the parties. There's no question about that. To the extent possible, I would add, because we had no idea about this real estate issue when we signed the settlement agreement. And to quote the language of the district court, This is at page 10 of the order. There are no express provisions in the settlement agreement related to the Frank II property, transfer of that property, the method or nature of for transfer, or provisions as to, quote, clear title or spousal deeds. That is such an accurate assessment of the language of the settlement agreement, that this issue was not contemplated and it is not provided for. If spousal deeds were required as part of this settlement, it should have been designated. There was a significantly detailed redemption agreement because we all thought that the real estate was held by the LLC. So the main focus was to make sure there was no claims by our clients, by the respondents, in Castle Highlands LLC. And that was covered very in detail. It was only until this issue came up later that we had to go back and look at the settlement agreement and try to figure out what was going on. One point I'd like to make with my remaining time.
Well, could I ask a question with the remaining time with regard to, I understand that you think that the argument with regard to the joint tenancy with right of survivorship is waived. Do we have in the record, is that the type of title that was held by your client and his wife, ex-wife? Is it a JTROS? And if so, you know, the appellant cited the, you know, joint tenancy statute that talks about severance of that issue, and it requires some extra actions on behalf of your client. And do we have evidence in the record that those actions have taken place?
So, Your Honor, I believe the default, and I don't think this is in the record, it might be in some of the emails between Mr. Christensen and me, but the default is joint tenancy, unless it's specified tenancy in common. I have, my time has expired. May I conclude?
You may.
Thank you. And so this would be joint tenant property, which was not raised at the district court, but I think helps our case. So maybe I shouldn't have been so aggressive in saying don't consider that. It wasn't raised, but the district court's decision is completely consistent with the notions of joint tenancy, that a spouse cannot unilaterally sever a joint tenancy with their other spouse. That requires the consent of the other.
But doesn't section 500.19 say that if it's not homestead property, your client could sever if they record that severance in the office of the county recorder where the real estate is situated? So isn't it possible for Frank III to sever his interest from his wife's interest by engaging that? Because I don't think there's any dispute about this being homestead property.
Correct, not homestead property. No one ever asked Frank to sign a severance of the joint tenancy. So it was presumed by probate counsel for the appellants that this was joint tenant, and the only way to get clean title was for the both spouses to sign quit claim deeds. And
well, that would make sense, right? Because it would turn it into tenancy in common. So whatever interest she has left, she would retain that interest separate from her husband.
Yep. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Judge Larson hit the nail on the head with our argument about attorney's fees. The original dispute and how this issue arose was respondent saying, we don't have to do anything with the real property. That spawned the entirety of this motion practice. And so when the court found that respondents had waived that argument, appellants were successful on that argument. And the record supports that argument. Again, I touched on it a lot in my principal argument, but the fact that the estate is a party to this settlement and the fact that this settlement also resolves a probate claim in a probate case is indicative of that. Regarding the attorney fee provision itself, again, appellants don't believe that that provision for awarding attorney's fees is optional. The way that the provision reads is the court has the authority to declare the prevailing party and then to direct that non-prevailing party to pay the prevailing party's attorney's fees. There is a split between those two things. If the intention was to give the court the option to award attorney's fees or not, that shall have the authority language, one would expect that to be repeated. Those are distinct, separate portions of that sentence, which is why appellants should be awarded their attorney's fees. And just to finish here, I want to touch on the joint tenancy argument. The district court allowed respondents to use the joint tenancy statute as both a sword and a shield. It said that Danielle Carpenter cannot be compelled to transfer her interest by Frank, but it allowed Frank III to purportedly transfer his interest. If the court wanted to read the joint tenancy statute as precluding Danielle from transferring her interest, the same argument would apply to Frank III, meaning Frank III.
This is my question. Does the statute, I mean, you cite KIPP, which quotes the Minnesota statute, section 500.19. I don't think anyone is disputing that this golf course is homestead property. So it seems like there is a provision by which Frank III could sever his portion of the joint tenancy, but it doesn't appear to me from the record that that is precisely what has actually occurred here. So it seems like Frank III might still, it still might be a joint tenancy under the existing statutory law, regardless of whatever quitclaim deed has been given to your client.
And Your Honor, that is the problem with the respondents failing to comply with the settlement agreement. This settlement agreement, and I understand the court has had some concerns about how can a settlement agreement...
Well, as a practical matter, how could Frank III force his ex-wife to transfer this interest in the property?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. That's for Frank III to figure out. I don't know if he goes and gets a signature from her. I don't. However, it's addressed in the divorce in Washington. The bottom line here is respondents indicated that they would transfer the property in its entirety to appellants. That didn't happen.
And when you say that, what are you relying on? What language in the settlement agreement?
Again, Your Honor, I'm relying on the provisions that we've already discussed and the agreement as a whole. There's no additional language that I would have to point the court to.
Mr. Kuba, maybe getting back to the kind of the beginning, if it was clearly or unambiguously the party's intention to require a spouse to do something, and wouldn't that be explicitly in the agreement? In other words, and especially if we're getting into the details, frankly, I'm not sure the relevance of the severance joint because, you know, getting back to that issue, if there was that obligation, then clearly you would have won because there would have been a breach because it hasn't happened, but it's just simply not in the agreement. And so how do you get to that point when a spouse is not a party? Moreover, there's no reference to a spouse and there's no obligation to obtain anything from the spouse as part in any of these provisions.
Certainly are. Within the settlement agreement, the respondents clearly indicate that they have the authority and can perform the promises they're agreeing to. One analogy the court can look at for this is if a homeowner hires a contractor to do work, and that contractor says, I will fix your bathroom, and that contractor goes out and hires a subcontractor to fix the bathroom, the homeowner can sue the contractor for the contractor's failure to perform under that particular obligation. Somewhat similar analogy here. Respondents indicated they had the authority and the ability to do what they promised, and they didn't or they couldn't.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Your time is up. Thank you for your helpful arguments here today. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time period.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.